Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. When you need life advice, who do you turn to? Someone close who knows you well? A family member, perhaps? Maybe you have one friend you'll talk through romantic advice with, and another you rely on for financial advice. Or would you prefer to trust a complete stranger to help you with some of your most intimate issues? For almost 20 years, thousands of people have relied on the syndicated advice column, Dear Prudence, with questions that range from, how can I stop my parents from complaining to me about their marriage, to, is it okay to share cigarettes with my 18-year-old child? The Column is now a weekly podcast produced here in the Bay Area and hosted by the Column's current author, Mallory Ortberg. Unlike other advice podcasts I've heard, Dear Prudence does such a wonderful job of providing clear, rational advice wrapped in very funny and very personal conversations. In this episode, Mallory and her guest co-host, author Saladin Ahmed, try to help a listener get a better night's sleep.
All right. This one makes me furious. I just want to warn you right now. You're going to have to hold me back. The subject line of this one is just, I'm tired. I have a lovely partner who I've been with for the last 6 years. Overall, things are great, but one problem persists. He likes to wake me up when I'm sleeping. Usually this happens when he gets home from a late shift, and he thinks it's cute to kiss me awake and ask about my day when I'm in a deep sleep. Or he will fall asleep on the couch watching TV, only to come up to bed and wake me with a question like, why did you leave me downstairs? Once he wakes me up, I have a really hard time falling asleep, whereas he can fall asleep anywhere instantly and is impossible to wake up. I've asked him many times to stop, but he seems to think it is cute and/or harmless, but it drives me crazy. What else can I do to drive my point home? He's a very empathetic guy normally. How can I phrase my request so that he might empathize? I think you should kill him. I'm sorry. I feel so strongly about not waking somebody up, especially when they've told you repeatedly not to do it. Like, it just, do you know what I mean? Like, when somebody wakes you up and you're not ready, it just awakens like the animal part of your brain. It's like something is trying to keep me from sleep and I will do anything to get back.
Yeah, no, I feel you. Hey, I had twins. My children awaken that instinct in me. So, I don't even know how to approach this question because I don't know the mentality of this. It's a he, right? That's doing this. That's waking this person up. Yes.
Right.
I don't understand the mentality that he has. That once they've asked once, twice, then don't wake them up. So I don't know how you get through to a person who still does that. And I almost don't believe when this person says he's a really empathetic guy normally. Why this one thing?
Yeah, I can, to a certain extent, like, I understand there have definitely been times in relationships when I thought I was doing something really funny and eventually the person I was seeing had to say, it actually really bothers me and I want you to knock it off.
Yeah.
But the idea of doing it repeatedly after that, especially about something like as important as sleep. I love sleep.
Exactly.
I don't think you should murder him. I need to stop advising people to commit murder on this podcast.
No, I mean, that's literal torture, though. I mean, this instance is, but an exaggerated version of this is like, you know, what they do to people who they detain, right? It's like you can't sleep when you need to sleep and want to sleep. I'm going to wake you up.
So
there's something deep in you that messes with, I think. And you are not wrong to have a violent reaction to that, I think.
So I think there's kind of two things that I would advise this person to do, none of which involve murder. And I want to hear if you think that this makes sense or seems reasonable. One of which is, you know, you want to try to have this conversation when you're both awake, because like when you're getting woken up in the middle of the night, like you react really reflexively. You might be really angry. You might say things that aren't helpful just because you're so upset. And I think it's a really good idea to have this conversation during the daytime and to phrase it as a question, like, can you help me with this? Like, you wake me up a lot. And I've told you when you do that, it's hard for me to fall back asleep. It's irritating. It's painful. It's bewildering. I don't like it. It ruins my sleep for the rest of the night. I'm tired the next day. And I've asked you repeatedly to stop. When I tell you all of this and you still do it, I don't understand. Can you explain to me what you're getting out of this, that you would repeatedly wake me up when I have asked you not to, knowing that it's going to like make the next day really difficult for me? Like, can you help me understand why? And you know, I don't have enormously high hopes for that conversation, but really like let him sit in that discomfort and kind of try to say, like, let him try to think through like, wow, what am I getting out of this? Why am I like on some kind of sadistic level enjoying like distressing you and pretending that it's cute when I know that it's not? And depending on how that goes, like, you might be able to have a meaningful conversation. Depending on, like, his answer might not be great. It might be, oh, it's not that big a deal. You're over-exaggerating. You're exaggerating. You're overreacting. I think you need to assume that as long as he's not going to stop, you need to set a really firm boundary. So it might be something like, I've asked you not to do it. I want you not to do it. If you do it again, I'm going to leave the house and sleep somewhere else. And I'm going to do that until I can trust you to act like an adult and let me sleep. And I know that that's kind of drastic, but I also think, like, if he doesn't respond to questions, if he doesn't respond to requests, if you try to have that conversation, he doesn't respond well to that, like, you need to think through, like, where can I go to get a full night's sleep? And, like, maybe that will only happen to have to happen a couple of times before he gets it through his head. Maybe it's going to continue to happen and you'll have to think through, like, is this a person I want to sleep with? Like, I just think like letting somebody sleep in peace is such a meaningful gift. Like, I can't imagine why you would take that away from them if they told you it bothers them. Yeah, like go to a hotel if you can afford it. Go to a friend's house if you can. Go to your like a family, like a sister or a brother's house, like somebody that you know will let you sleep all night.
Yeah.
And sleep there. Because, you know,
you're
going to eventually kill him, you know, like eventually you will be so sleep deprived that he will wake you up and without thinking, you will just like push him out a window.
Yeah. See, I would even just skip the asking him stage, you know, because he's not going to have anything useful to say. I think it's, you know, just like one morning, you know, or one evening, depending on what works for you before bed or after you guys wake up, you know, change your routine. You know, if you guys usually wake up together and whatever, brush your teeth together, whatever, have breakfast, you know, change it up, get up before him, something, you know, break into his routine and sit there and, you know, look at him and be like, look, you know, I don't feel well this morning. It's because I didn't sleep last night, you know? And like you were saying, you know, just say, this is just stress how serious this is. And tell him I can't keep doing this and I'm going to sleep somewhere else if this happens again.
I was starting to think that you were going to recommend that, like, the letter writer wake their partner up, like retaliation. This is much better.
No, because
I don't think you should retaliate.
It's not the same for everybody. I mean, for me, I'm the same way. Like, my sleep can be f***ed up very easily. Am I allowed to curse?
Yeah, go for it.
My sleep can be messed up very easily, and I, you know, but not everybody's like that. You know, I've certainly had partners where, like, you know, they just go right back to sleep and no big deal. You know what I'm saying? And so it might not hit this guy.
Right. But that's what's so frustrating about this is like the letter writer says, like, I've told him that I don't like this. I've told him that I have trouble falling back asleep. Like, this is not like, oh, he's laboring under like a false impression. He knows that the letter writer doesn't like this.
Yeah. But I think there is something to be said for sort of both interrupting your normal routine and really stressing this, as you're saying, when you're awake, rather than just kind of saying, hey, don't do this when you're sleeping. And like you're saying, just making clear that there are going to be consequences. Of course, the thing is, you know, the letter writer has to be clear whether in their mind, how far they're going to go. You know, is this somebody that you care so much about and that you're so into that you know you're going to keep putting up with this, you know? Or not. And you got to kind of, that's really what's at the core.
And I think,
so you got to sort that out. you know?
Yeah, I think even more than calling this a consequence, because I think one trap that you want to try to avoid, and I realize this is a little hypocritical because I told you to murder him earlier, is it's not punishment, right? You're not saying, like, because you're such a partner, I'm going to punish you by withdrawing. What you're doing is stating a need. And the need is uninterrupted night's sleep.
Yeah, but to me, I don't mean, when I say consequence, I don't mean necessarily punitive. I just mean the result.
Oh, for sure.
You know?
Right. Right. I'm just kind of thinking through how this conversation could possibly go a bit wrong and trying to anticipate that. So just like make it really clear. I'm not doing this to get back at you. I'm not doing this because I want to hurt you. I'm doing this because it seems like this is the only way that I can get a full night's sleep.
Exactly.
I would love to do that in our bed with you.
Yeah.
It seems like that's not possible right now. So until it is, I'm going to sleep somewhere else. And, you know, if his response to that is to kind of get it together and knock it off, great. You guys can kind of have some more conversation about your dynamic and move on. And if he doesn't, I got to say, this kind of feels like a deal breaker to me. It sounds like it happens a lot.
Exactly.
This is not like a little thing. This is like,
no,
I need my sleep.
Every night.
And if you can't
I mean,
let me do that.
Brain.
Yeah. Sleep is such a need. It's like breathing and eating. Like you can't go without it. Especially when it's just to talk about your day. My day is over. It's night now. Don't ask me about my day. The day already happened.
You're not valuing the other person's health. You know what I'm saying? That's a pretty big effing thing, you know?
Right. Yeah. Oh, this, I wasn't expecting to spend like this much time on this letter, but it's just really, I'm angry just like secondhand imagining someone doing that to me. We would be broken up. It would be over. If it happened three times, it would be done.
Dear Prudence is hosted by Mallory Ortberg, and our guest was author Saladin Ahmed. The Dear Prudence podcast is produced by Casey Miner and Audrey Dilling and distributed by Slate. Find more episodes and links to subscribe to the podcast at slate.com/prudipod. That's PRUDIEPOD. If you have a question that you'd like Mallory's help solving, you can leave them a message at 401-371-DEAR. That's 401-371-3327. You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories from indie radio producers and podcasts. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. As Mallory enthusiastically pointed out, sleep is necessary for every human's health and sanity and should be taken seriously. And now, instead of hearing from people who are trying to help someone get the sleep they need, we'll find out about the people whose job it is to stop folks from falling asleep in the first place. The podcast, 99% Invisible, usually tells stories about how a design is envisioned and implemented, mostly for items and systems that bring us a lot of comfort and make our lives easier. In this episode, they flip that script and focus on how design can be used to intentionally inhibit behaviors, including our most natural ones, like sleep.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. Around the corner from our office in beautiful downtown Oakland, California, is DeLauer's Newsstand. It has been there since 1907. For the people who live and work downtown, it is central to our existence. Everyone goes there to buy drinks, lottery tickets, little packs of fruit-flavored cigarillos, and occasionally, even a newspaper.
163.
But about 8 months ago, it became clear that even though DeLauer's wants a bunch of people inside the store buying things, they don't want a bunch of people outside their store hanging out on the sidewalk. Here's how you can tell. DeLauer started playing really loud classical music through a speaker outside. And although I still see a fair number of people hanging out in front of the place, the owner says it's not nearly as many as before.
Oh, big change. It was mess. They hung out outside and, you know, just they're playing dice on the street outside the door. And it was crazy. But now it helps us a lot. Even the customer telling us they see the change on the street here. I'm the owner of DeLauer's Newsstand. My name is Fasil Lama.
When you have classical music, people who are young and cool don't really hang out there. So that's a way to deter teenagers.
That is Selena Savage.
And I am co-author of the research project about unpleasant design.
Playing classical music on loudspeakers is an example of what Selena calls unpleasant design.
Unpleasant design is something that works well at deterring certain behaviors and certain uses from particularly public spaces.
Along with her partner Gordon Savicic, Selena collects and catalogs unpleasant designs.
Unpleasant design was here since we started designing public space or since we started designing cities.
Unpleasant designs are meant to exert a kind of social control in public by targeting people who spend a lot of time in public spaces, especially the young and the homeless. And the designs often end up pushing these so-called undesirable people out of one space and into another. Music is only one method for deterring teens from public space. In 2009, the Nottinghamshire Housing Estates in England installed pink lighting to keep kids from congregating.
Pink lights, which would emphasize the skin, like blemishes on teenagers, which should result in teenagers not hanging out there. That's one of my favorite examples.
Mine too, although there's not a lot of evidence that proves how effective it is. Pink lighting that preys on teenagers' insecurities is funny and kind of devious, if a little far-fetched. Another more substantiated example of targeting and trying to eliminate undesirable behavior with light is the presence of blue lighting in public restrooms. I saw this in UK train stations quite a bit last time I was there.
Blue light of a particular color makes the veins slightly less visible.
You can't see your veins through your skin, so it's hard to find a target if you're an intravenous drug user.
Then it became a very popular solution for all kind of publicly accessible toilets and even sometimes in buses. When your veins are not visible to you, you're obviously not going to be able to take any heroin.
According to Selena, lights are one of the original forms of public social control. For example,
there was a bridge in a small town in Bosnia.
Specifically in the Kasbah of Visegrad, Bosnia, in the early 1900s.
Where the Austrian government, who kind of annexed the country at that time, decided to implement street lighting, and that was very unpleasant to the locals, and the locals would destroy the light every night, and the government would reinstall it every morning. And so the idea that light is something unpleasant for free expression in public space is something that we completely forgot.
We've since become so habituated to public lighting that our primary experience with streetlights is that they deter criminal activity and make us feel safe. Unless you're someone who laments the lack of stars in the night sky or lives in an apartment with a window right next to a screamingly bright bulb, you might never view streetlights as unpleasant at all. Which is one of the reasons why the Unpleasant Design Project wants to point it out, so that it gets recognized as being part of an overall design scheme that can take on a much uglier manifestation.
Well, these studs may only be a few centimeters tall, but they've caused a big debate.
This is from a BBC News story from 2014. The reporter, Nick Beek, is pointing to a set of angry-looking spikes that were installed in the concrete floor of a small alcove by the entrance to an apartment building. The spikes are clearly meant to stop people from sitting or lying there.
Is this a legitimate way to prevent rough sleeping and possible antisocial behavior, or are they a symbol of a heartless approach to homelessness?
Psst, hey, do you want to know the answer? It's the second one.
That spiked a huge debate, and even the mayor of London reacted and said that they should be removed and that we should not address homeless people in this way.
The grocery chain Tesco also added spikes to areas outside the entrance to one of its stores in central London in 2014. They were removed after days of public protest.
Generally, the debate was about the way we treat homelessness, and is that something that we just want to remove from a particular space, or is it something that we should somehow structurally address?
Spikes to stop people from sitting or lying down evoked a wide variety of reactions from the public.
The first time I saw someone lying here, a homeless couple actually, I didn't like it because I didn't like having to walk by them. That sounds very selfish. So when I saw those studs, I thought, good idea.
So a lot of people are bothered by the presence of homeless people, but some are also alarmed by just how aggressive the spikes are.
It's almost looks harmful. You know, if you lie on those, you're going to get spiked. And so it sends that message, which I think is wrong.
It's worth saying that these spikes are not just in England. We have them in the US too. Outside of our office is a window ledge where you naturally want to sit. And sure enough, there are these black metal doorknob looking things that keep anyone from resting there. And one thing that makes these spikes and similar features especially frustrating is that they're just there. They're not moving. There's no arguing with them.
You know, if you have a policeman who prohibits people from sleeping in a park, I think there is still some possible negotiation. And I think that's good. That's what society is about, the ongoing negotiation and ongoing change. But when we start using things that are immutable and unchangeable, like metal spikes, there is nothing that is going to change until they rust. I think that's the most important criteria for calling something unpleasant design. It is something that you cannot negotiate with.
We have all tried and probably failed to negotiate with one of the most common and aggravating forms of unpleasant design, public seating. Whether it's in a park or at a bus stop or in an airport, there are countless ways designers have made it so you cannot get comfortable and most especially cannot lie down.
A classic is the bench with armrests in between, which of course let you rest your arm on the armrest, but at the same time they restrict any other kind of use than sitting upright. The only way this bench can be used is by three people sitting next to each other and not looking at each other, which is not the only thing you can do on a bench. Especially, it's not the only normal and legal thing you can do on a bench.
Selena thinks that limiting the way something can be used is problematic.
By attacking or addressing one particular problem, you actually generate many more problems and reduce complexity of possible behaviors in public space.
It's not just dividers and armrests. In the Unpleasant Design book, they also point out benches that are mounted so high that your feet can't touch the ground, and therefore they're uncomfortable after a short period of time. And they document an increased prevalence of leaning supports at bus stops that you can rest against while standing, but they do not accommodate sitting or sleeping. But the object that Selena considers the masterpiece of unpleasant design is the Camden bench.
Basically, it is a design solution to 22, I think, antisocial behavior problems. The only thing it does not deter is sitting.
The Camden Bench, so named because it was commissioned by Camden London Borough Council, is a strange, angular, sculpted, solid lump of concrete with rounded edges and slopes in unexpected places. A critic on Medium named Frank Swain called it the perfect anti-object. Anti-sleeping because the shape makes it uncomfortable to sleep on. Anti-drug dealing because there are no slots or crevices in which to hide drugs. Anti-theft because the recesses near the ground allow people to store bags behind their legs and away from would-be criminals. Anti-skateboard because the edges on the bench fluctuate in height, making grinding difficult. Anti-litter because there are no surfaces or crevices where litter can accrue. Anti-graffiti because it has a special coating to repel paint. And all those goals are pretty noble, except for sleeping and skateboarding. I don't really want the other activities happening in public spaces I go to either. But Selena Savic finds this litany of anti-measures demoralizing.
It discourages 22 things. It encourages two: sitting and sitting together. When we expect people to do bad things to the bench before we think of anything good that people might do to this bench, I think that's a very sad approach to public space.
It's also a contagious approach to public space. There's a chapter in the Unpleasant Design book that's devoted to all the unpleasant designs used to thwart pigeons in cities. Anti-pigeon spikes and nets are everywhere. And even if you're like Selena and aware of these measures and skeptical of our war on pigeons, you might not have a choice in whether or not to use them.
A week after we have published the book, we had a confirmation of this. We didn't even notice, but on the balcony doors, we actually had anti-pigeon spikes. And then due to somebody hanging out on the balcony who was, clumsy, and they destroyed these spikes on one side, and we didn't even notice that, suddenly the balcony was filled with pigeon shit.
Pigeons might not be overwhelming if the population is spread throughout a city, but the ubiquity of pigeon spikes concentrate pigeons in the few places where there are no spikes. Selena argues that's when the problem is created.
And that should not be the way to solve any kind of interest conflicts over a space. But yes, we immediately fixed our spikes.
There is always an aspect of coercion to design. Design is used to get you to buy things, to use your iPhone in a certain way, sometimes without you even being aware of it. And these pieces of hostile and unpleasant architecture are no different.
Design is something that is supposed to transmit a certain use of this object. Otherwise, it would have not been designed. However, I think it is very problematic when we start excluding people by design.
The reason we need a critical theory of unpleasant design is so we can recognize the coercion that is taking place in our public spaces. We need to know when we're replacing human interaction and nuance and empathy with hard, physical, non-negotiable solutions.
And this is what we wanted to achieve with this book, to start the debate. There will always be people who believe this is a good way and people who think it's terrible. And we are somehow not extreme in our opinion. We're really the observers.
And now you're an observer too. Whether you think a certain form of design is exclusionary but serves a greater good, or just hostile and offensive, it's important to be aware of the decisions that are being made for you, because most likely, unpleasant design is put there to make things more pleasant for someone just like you. Invisible is Sam Greenspan, Delaney Hall, Kurt Kohlstedt, Katie Mingle, Avery Truffleman, Sharif Youssef, and me, Roman Mars. A bunch of the music this week came from our pal Melodium. Your life will improve measurably when you buy and incorporate Melodium into your daily routine. It'll be like being inside a 99% Invisible episode all the time. Find Melodium on Bandcamp and on Abandoned Building Records. We are a project of 91.7 KALW San Francisco and produced out of the offices of ArcSign, an architecture and interiors firm in beautiful downtown Oakland, California.
You can find this episode and more at KALW.org, and you'll find The Spot under the Programs tab. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Tune in next Sunday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.